You're listening to the Diplomats podcast on Asian geopolitics. As always, I'm Ankit Panda, your host, joined by my colleague at the Diplomat, Prashant Parameswaran. Thanks for joining me as usual, Prashant. How are you doing today?
Good. How are you?
Doing well. So our last episode on Duterte seemed to have been quite popular, and I just wanted to update listeners since we actually had a little bit of poor timing with that. We did it after Duterte's insults to Obama in Vientiane, but since we recorded that podcast, there have been quite a few developments on the Philippines front. We won't be talking about those on this episode, but just to let people know that if you're interested in trying to figure out Duterte, like I figure a lot of people are, not only listeners of The Diplomat, but also certainly U.S. officials and other diplomats around the world, we'll definitely revisit that beat. On today's episode, however, I do want to revisit the Indian subcontinent, where tensions between India and Pakistan have risen again after early Sunday morning militants attacked an Indian brigade headquarters in the town of Uri in Kashmir. Now, this attack left 18 Indian Army soldiers dead and about 30 injured, making it one of the worst attacks on the Indian Army since at least 2002, so definitely in a long time. And cross-border skirmishes between the two sides aren't that uncommon, but something like this, involving a group of essentially proxy attackers, which is what the Indian government has concluded, echoing Pakistan's previous strategy, is really quite a watershed moment in the Kashmir Valley. And there's a lot of context that we can go into. So essentially, in a pre-dawn raid, about four militants stormed the base, which is about 12 miles from the line of control, with assault rifles, grenade launchers, incendiary ammunition, which actually lit a few tents on fire. And the Indian reaction was swift. Indian Home Affairs Minister Rajnath Singh referred to Pakistan as a terrorist state following the attack. And essentially, he immediately provided his assessment that the perpetrators of the Uri attack were highly trained, heavily armed, and specially equipped, and said that he was deeply disappointed that Pakistan continued to support terrorism and terrorist groups. So this has really come at an interesting time as well, which we can maybe get into a little bit further down the discussion. But, you know, there's a lot of context here that I do want to bring up. Specifically, in January this year, we had a very similar incident take place, although not in Kashmir, in Punjab at the Pathankot Indian Air Force Base. Last July, there was a similar incident also in Punjab at Gurdaspur, where infiltrators from across the Pakistani border, according to Indian sources, attacked a police station in the Punjab city of Gurdaspur. So Uri, in this sense, is a continuation of those strategies. And I should point out at the beginning of this podcast that there's a lot that's unknown at this point, and politics and media being the way they are in the Indian subcontinent, Indian media claims have been a little bit overblown. I'll talk a bit about what the Indian government has said. The Indian government was very quick to double down on the fact that these attackers were infiltrators from across the line of control, the border demarcating Indian-administered Kashmir and Pakistan-administered Kashmir. Uri, for listeners who might not be aware of the geography of Kashmir, is about 12 miles from the line of control, and it sits on the bank of a river. It's in the Baramulla district of Kashmir. So the Indians essentially alleged that these attackers had managed to enter India, enter the Indian side of the LOC, and stage this attack. Making matters more difficult, these attackers were what are known as Fidayeen, essentially a suicide squad of attackers. And also, like in the cases of Gurdaspur and Pathankot, essentially they came to their targets knowing that they wouldn't be going back, which really makes it a difficult problem for the Indian armed forces to deal with. As long as Pakistan can find willing proxies willing to die in these suicide raids, there's very little that they can do, and essentially these attacks could continue on getting more spectacular with time. I'll maybe let you talk a bit about this additional context, but you know, it's been a hot summer in the Kashmir Valley, particularly with protests that really blew up after the killing of a Hizbul Mujahideen militant by the name of Burhan Wani. Beginning with his funeral, essentially, Kashmiri youth took to the streets, and there's been a lot of international coverage of the Indian Army's heavy-handed tactics. So Pakistan naturally seems to be trying to capitalize on the opportunity presented here, since, you know, Islamabad has been generally keen to have the Kashmiri dispute internationalized, and September again is when world leaders convene at the United Nations in New York. So there's really a lot going on, and it's a complex situation. But know, Prashant, I wanted to turn it over to you. Any other context you want to add here before we maybe talk about, you know, some of the policy responses and the domestic debate in India?
No, I think you touched on the several components pretty well in terms of the context in Kashmir, the domestic developments, the India-Pakistan context, as well as the international timing and the context of the United Nations, which I think is very important.
So did you follow Nawaz Sharif's speech today at the UN?
I did, yeah. And I think, you know, that's already been, you know, inspiring, you know, fierce debate on both sides.
Yeah. So just to update listeners, we're recording this on Wednesday, September 21st. So earlier today, Nawaz Sharif, the Pakistani Prime Minister, spoke at the United Nations, and he actually, you know, addressed the issue of Kashmir very directly, you know, called for self-determination, actually brought up Burhan Wani, the Hizbul Mujahideen militant, who's and that group is actually considered a terrorist organization by the European Union, the United States, and India alike. He brought his name up, which really upset the Indians at the UN. But, you know, Prashant, what do you make about, you know, the possible timing of this attack? Do you think, you know, this is essentially a bid to internationalize the Kashmir dispute before the United Nations was scheduled to meet in New York?
Yeah, I mean, I think many commentators have pointed to the fact that the timing is really important in terms of not only the attack, but also India's response. Because as you correctly pointed out, if one of the reasons for the attack, or even if the attack wasn't conducted for that reason, Pakistan is trying to internationalize the Kashmir issue, India should not play into Pakistan's hands by trying to worsen the situation or react violently, because that would not only not be constructive, but also shift the potential blame or attention to the Indian side. I think Nawaz Sharif's speech at the United Nations has resulted in, you know, more of the same from both sides. I think he, you know, both of us have listened to the speech. I think he, you know, mentioned similar grievances from the Pakistani side in terms of, you know, extrajudicial killings and, you know, grave human rights violations. And from the Indian side, the response was, you know, why would, after this attack happened, you would glorify a terrorist, and why Pakistan can't seem to do something basic like, you know, end terrorism, so that if Pakistan and India wanted to talk about the Kashmir dispute, they'd be able to do it in a situation where there's at least a basic norm where they both won't engage in terrorist attacks against each other. So.
Right. So let's, you know, talk a bit about what both sides have been doing. I talked a bit about the context, but I think it's instructive here to talk about the Modi government's approach to Pakistan. And I'll talk a bit about that approach before Kashmir blew up this summer, because I think, you know, that's the important context here, which is, you know, Modi's been in power for about 2 years. And the thing you have to understand about the Pakistani side is that, you know, we're talking a lot about Nawaz Sharif, but he's not really the guy making all the calls in Pakistan, particularly when it comes to foreign and security policy, given the Pakistan Muslim League government's domestic weakness, actually, over the years, over the past 2 years. In particular, the Pakistani army has essentially restored itself as the traditional guarantor of Pakistan's state and foreign affairs. And that's really, you know, shown itself in a variety of ways. We could also talk about, you know, how Pakistan's cross-border activities have manifested in Afghanistan, certainly. But the point being, you know, Nawaz Sharif isn't really the man to talk about here. It's generally, you know, the Pakistani deep state as manifested through the intelligence services and the military. And for them, you know, Kashmir has obviously been a big part of their raison d'etre, and the use of proxy groups against India isn't really anything new. You know, there's quite a bit of evidence, for example, with the Pathankot and Gurdaspur attacks that Ajaish and Mohammed, a group led by Masood Azhar, who was also involved in the early 2000s in a series of attacks on Indian targets, you know, those attackers carried out the incident. But what's interesting is that the Modi government's approach towards Pakistan has been quite restrained, and there's been a lot of reaching out at a high level. I've talked about this on the podcast before several times, but, you know, Modi kicked off his term by inviting all of South Asia's leaders to his inauguration, including Nawaz Sharif, last year on December 25th, on Christmas Day, on his way back from Afghanistan, he actually dropped in on Nawaz Sharif at his personal residence in Lahore on a surprise visit. So there's really been, you know, a bit of diplomatic showmanship from the Modi government, and critics in India, hawkish critics in India, have essentially said that, you know, this kind of high-level political outreach has really yielded nothing. Simply, you know, days after Modi pulled off his surprise visit on Nawaz Sharif's residence, the Pathankot attack happened. And similarly, you know, this attack, I think, shows that the Modi government's approach towards Pakistan really hasn't been working. And, you know, it's not a matter of the Modi government being too weak or being too strong. You know, I think the prescription that I sort of brought up in the piece that I wrote immediately in the aftermath of the Uri attack is that, you know, this might be a lesson for the Modi government that Pakistan, you know, the right approach here might essentially be to ignore Pakistan at a high level and leave India's Pakistan diplomacy to the bureaucrats and, you know, spend the high-octane prime ministerial energy in other pursuits, both in the neighborhood and globally. I mean, there's a lot that Modi can focus on, but Pakistan, you know, isn't really turning out to be a productive use of his time diplomatically. But Prashant, you know, obviously in India, calls for the use of force against Pakistan have grown quite a bit. I think I just saw a poll after the Uri attack that essentially showed around 63% of Indians were in favor of a militarized response. And the calls for the use of force really extend from everything from a surgical special operating forces strike into Pakistani territory to, you know, something a little bit more dramatic. But obviously, when you're talking about the India-Pakistan relationship, you do have the nuclear sword of Damocles hanging over the equation as well. But what's your sense of, you know, India's best options in dealing with this problem of Pakistan-sponsored terrorism?
Yeah, so I think the as you pointed out, I mean, the context is really important in that the Modi government thus far has been pretty restrained. And I think the initial inclination will be, as it has proceeded thus far, to make sure that the response is, even though rhetorically Modi has said that the attack will not go unpunished, most of the actions thus far have been focused in the diplomatic domain, whether it's you know, summoning the Pakistani High Commissioner or sort of a broader campaign of international isolation against the Pakistanis more generally. I think that you're right that there's been a variety of options that commentators and even former military advisors and personnel in India have talked about. You know, some have mentioned the special forces raid. There have been other sort of scenarios being put about firing across the line of control, infiltrating and striking border posts in Pakistan. But, you know, as you correctly pointed out, and as we well know, I mean, all of these options are not exactly as attractive as they may seem. I mean, first of all, I mean, there is the tendency that there could be a counter reaction by the Pakistanis, and we're talking about two nuclear powers. But I think the bigger point is that, you know, what is the end game here for India if it's trying to strike or engage in it beyond just reacting swiftly to curb public pressure? I think part of the reason why the Modi government has been reluctant to engage in these kinds of actions before is that it realizes that there is a sort of a trade-off here, in the sense that if it is restrained and it absorbs this public outcry for more action, India does get a lot of the international community on its side. And I think particularly on one aspect that's been very clear, if you look at the United States, for example, Pakistan has done a really good job in the last few years isolating itself. You look at the changing perception in Capitol Hill alone, and that's been quite striking. So there is a bit of a delicate balance here. I think there is going to be an inclination to, with such a big public outcry and the fact that this is, you know, far from the first attack that we've seen in the last few years, there's going to be an inclination to try to react or strike out in one way. But there's also going to be a more measured sense that the diplomatic options are simply better for India than the military options. The other thing I will say is, I mean, there are more measured and sensible initiatives or moves that people are calling for. You know, tightening security at some of these border posts and making sure that perimeter security is hardened, ensuring that there are different things that India could do about how it coordinates its various services and some of its capabilities, right? And how it uses existing resources. And if India can focus on those, that might enable it to take future responses that might be more effective, whether it's defensive in nature or they're more surgical in nature going forward. I mean, some of the options that I've seen, I have to be frank, some of the military measures that I've been seeing, some people have been suggesting, well, if India can just really quickly strike Pakistan before the international community finds out and tries to crack down on India, then this will succeed. I mean, this kind of scenario doesn't work. It doesn't work like that anymore. I mean, the world is informed immediately as to what the situation is going on, and other countries are very quick to talk to both countries about what they should and should not do. So the international attention is there. The key for India and for Pakistan, but I would argue New Delhi in particular, is that it needs to think about the trade-offs between the things that it's going to do militarily and the things it can do diplomatically.
Yeah, absolutely, Prashant. I totally agree with what you just said. And, you know, another angle that I think a lot of commentators in India have been talking about, not only in response to the Uri attack, but more generally, is, you know, the Balochistan angle. And I think a lot of this, you know, came up in the aftermath of the Doval Doctrine. Ajit Doval, the Indian National Security Advisor, in a speech, you know, stirred up quite a bit of attention when he said, "You may do one Mumbai," referring to the 2008 catastrophic attacks by Lashkar-e-Taiba militants in Mumbai. But he said that, you know, "You may lose one Balochistan," essentially threatening Pakistan. And in some ways, you know, stoking conspiracy theories in Pakistan that the Indian intelligence services are pulling all the strings in Balochistan, where there is a nationalist uprising against Pakistani government rule. But also, you know, Modi very recently in his August Independence Day speech mentioned the issue of Balochistan directly. So, you know, that's again another angle to all this. But I think your point on, you know, India's other options is very well taken, because if there's one area where India and Pakistan essentially have a degree of parity is, you know, when it comes to hard power. And that's primarily due to the nuclear balance. India just simply doesn't control the nuclear escalation ladder, you know, because Pakistan's been playing with tactical nuclear weapons, and essentially Pakistan has no declaratory, no first use policy, making any sort of Indian military action highly dangerous. India does have a larger quantitative advantage when it comes to conventional forces, but that's largely moot when you're playing with nuclear weapons. On the diplomatic side, you know, like you identified, Prashant, I mean, India has the upper hand, not only with the international community, but with the United States, and certainly in the neighborhood. I mean, it's interesting to note that in the weeks before this attack, you know, you had Ujjain Jha of Myanmar, Prachanda of Nepal, and Ashraf Ghani from Afghanistan, just to name a few leaders, stop by in New Delhi. And really, you know, why I promoted this idea of India essentially leaving its Pakistan policy to the bureaucrats in South Bloc is to, you know, essentially New Delhi can leverage its position broadly within the neighborhood to isolate Pakistan more broadly. And again, you know, I don't see that as actually having any sort of reasonable feedback on Pakistan's use of proxy groups against India, because like I said, if you, you know, entertain this idea that Pakistan's foreign and security policy are nearly entirely being directed by the military, I think, you know, there's very little incentive for them to back down, even if the civilian government knows that, you know, this policy is really not going to be effective longer term. But, you know, I think an interesting angle in all this is this, you know, unfortunate summer in the Kashmir Valley, which has really, you know, played into Pakistan's hand in some ways. And I wanted to get your thoughts here. I mean, you know, one of the things that I've been reading from some Pakistani commentators who, you know, I mean, deny the fact that Pakistan had anything to do with this attack, essentially siding with the government's position, is that, well, look, I mean, India's been you know, clamping down, violating human rights, committing extrajudicial killings. Essentially, the Uri attack was simply an organic act of vengeance in the Kashmir Valley. And, you know, I know, you know, I personally don't believe that, obviously, but, and, you know, I don't think that gets much currency in India. But it's interesting how, you know, Pakistan is trying to use this summer in Kashmir as a way to, you know, set up a big public relations win ahead of the United Nations. You know, Sharif was going to push for Pakistan's old position to have a plebiscite or a referendum held in the valley under the aegis of, you know, one of the first UN resolutions, UN Resolution 47, Security Council Resolution 47. But, you know, how do you think Pakistan's played its cards after this summer in the valley?
Yeah, I mean, I think you saw Sharif say in his speech pretty pretty clearly. I think at one point he actually said, if we don't resolve the Kashmir issue, there's not going to be peace between India and Pakistan. So I think there definitely has been a focus by the Pakistanis on this issue more broadly. I think in terms of how they played their cards, diplomatically, I think they're counting on the fact that they can focus on the broader big picture issue of Kashmir, and that this attack will simply be contextualized in that sort of broader, bigger picture. My sense is that, though, it's not really going to pay off that significantly, in the sense that, we've seen a number of these attacks already, and I would actually credit the Modi government's restraint thus far, in the sense that, as I mentioned earlier, it has really led to this international response that increasingly is favoring India, because you have the Pakistanis or proxies coming up with several attacks, and India has been not only restrained but actually has been proactively, as you pointed out earlier, taking different steps towards potential peace with Pakistan. So this idea that Pakistan, after an attack like this, coming around and saying, "Hey, India, you have to address this broader question before we can tackle these specific issues," doesn't really hold much water in terms of connecting the two. Now, of course, we can all admit that, it would be great if India and Pakistan could come to some agreement on the Kashmir question. Unfortunately, as you pointed out, we're not dealing necessarily with two states where the heads of state are the ones that, are either making the decisions necessarily, or even are subject to pressures from different institutions that are very powerful, right? So, irrespective of what India and Pakistan's leaders want to do, they're increasingly held hostage by these other forces, whether it's public pressure, or the military, or even international public opinion. And I think if I were to compare between how India and Pakistan are managing these various forces, I would say the Indian government has been doing a much better job relative to Pakistan. But if you look at it from Nawaz Sharif's perspective or the Pakistan perspective, and you view Pakistan as already having a very weak hand relative to India, there are those in Pakistan who are very cynical, who would argue that Pakistan is playing a weak hand very well, in the sense that Pakistan is using these asymmetric tactics, which are really the only weapon that they have credibly to use against India, combined with a well-timed campaign of diplomatic pressure, timed with the UN, to leverage that, as these are basically really the only weapons that Pakistan really has in its arsenal relative to India.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely a good point. And I think it's actually, to nerd out for a bit, I think that's actually a great demonstration of the, international relations concept of the stability instability paradox, is when you have,
Absolutely.
two nuclear armed neighbors, the chances of conventional outright war decreases dramatically, but you get these, subconventional and a proxy encounters increasing dramatically. And we also saw that during the Cold War. And unfortunately, it seems like something that the Indian subcontinent is just going to have to deal with going forward. I'll add, Prashant, as a final note that, and I wrote about this in my piece, is that I think for the Modi government, this trifecta of Gurdaspur, Pathankot, and now Uri, which is the worst casualty Indian armed forces have suffered in some time, I think that'll essentially force a rethink on this whole idea of, high-level theatrics and engagement, hugging Nawaz Sharif and landing in Lahore dramatically. I think either, India is going to start talking loudly, even though it might not use its stick, but, I think those days are over. And meanwhile, for Pakistan, I think one of the things I'd watch for is, Rahil Sharif, the chief of army staff, arguably the most powerful person in the country, certainly that's not Nawaz Sharif, is set to retire in November. And it'll be worth seeing, who his successor is, or if he decides to pull a last-minute extension of his term, since whoever the chief of army staff is in Pakistan is always worth watching.
Totally.
All right, Prashant. Well, thanks for joining me. And we'll keep an eye on this Uri attack thing, because there's more details emerging every hour, it seems. So for listeners, thanks for listening as usual, and make sure you subscribe to the podcast on your platform of choice. And if you haven't already, do leave us a review as well. That really helps the podcast gain a wider audience. And if there's something you'd like to hear us talk about, definitely feel free to reach out to me or Prashant on social media. Thanks a lot for listening.